All right, we're back on the record in the Theory 2 and the King and Mead proceedings. Ms. Renzi, you may proceed. Dr. Posian is back on the witness stand. Once again, I remind you, sir, that you're still under oath.
Thank you, ma'am.
Dr. Posian, on pages 24 and 25 of your report.
Yes, ma'am.
You list six pieces of evidence that you say, if taken alone, leave some doubt, but if taken together, implicate thimerosal as the etiology of some autism spectrum disorders. Do you agree with that?
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to go through those six pillars. And I know you discussed this yesterday, and we'll discuss it today. The first one is the ADAMS study, the tooth study. And I believe you wrote and testified that this study found that teeth from autistic children contained more mercury than those of non-autistic children, correct?
Yes.
And that demonstrated that autistic children have a higher body burden of mercury than non-autistic children. Is that an accurate description?
I have the statement here, just that ADAMS demonstrated that teeth from autistic children contain more mercury than those from non-autistic children.
Does that demonstrate a higher, is it your opinion that that demonstrates a higher body burden of mercury in autistic children compared to non-autistic children?
Do I say here that it does?
I'm asking if that's your opinion. Can you conclude that?
It demonstrates, the teeth have been used as, the answer is yes.
Can you cite to any peer-reviewed articles that demonstrate that tooth mercury concentrations reflect mercury body burden?
That, would you repeat the question, please?
Can you
talk
cite,
into the microphone, please?
Can you cite to any peer-reviewed articles that demonstrate that tooth mercury concentrations reflect mercury body burden?
I can just state that there is the there's evidence that lead, zinc, and other metals, including mercury, which are increased in teeth, are a reflection of the amount of mercury in the body and the other tissues. This has been clearly shown for lead by Needleman in his very classic studies on lead, and it's been shown by other people too. The teeth have been used as a marker.
For mercury body burden?
For mercury, in this case, ADAMS has done it.
You testified in Cedillo that teeth are not excretory organs, correct? What are teeth excretory organs? Do you
Did I say it was an excretory organ?
You said it was not.
Yeah, I haven't thought about it. It's considered to be a tissue, an organ that takes up phosphate, it takes up calcium, many other things.
Now, you stated in your testimony today, and I believe yesterday, that all papers are subject to review and criticism. You said all papers, any peer-reviewed article, you show them to your students and you get criticisms of all papers that are peer-reviewed. Is that correct?
Yes.
What are your criticisms of the ADAMS study?
Of the
ADAMS study?
I think most people, I don't have the paper in front of me, probably the number of controls that he got could have been increased. And that's probably true with many studies, that the number of autistic, the number of teeth, the teeth, the number of autistic children that contributed teeth and the number of controlled children that contributed teeth is probably small.
Do you recall how many controls or...
I don't have the paper in front of me. I read over 100... I read many papers, and there are certain things that I know I can just go back and look at.
Would you like us to hand you the Adams study?
Pardon? Ah, okay, thank you. Thank you. N was 15 with autism spectrum disorder, and N was 11 typically developing children.
Were the levels of mercury found in the autistic, in the teeth of the autistic children, were they indicative of mercury toxicity?
I don't think there have been enough studies performed to have used teeth as an indication of mercury toxicity or teeth as a biomarker. I don't know of any studies that have taken teeth from severely mercury toxic people and examine them for mercury.
Well, what was the average mercury level of the teeth in the autistic children reported by Adams? And you can see table 2 on page 4 if that's helpful.
For autistic children, it was 0.15.
Is that indicative of mercury toxicity?
I don't know. But it is more than what's in the controls.
Do you know whether mercury levels vary depending upon the tooth, whether it's an incisor, a canine, a molar?
I don't know that.
Would you expect mercury concentrations to vary depending upon the sex of a child?
Yes.
Do you know whether the Adams study controlled for gender?
I don't know where usually there are more autistic boys than there are autistic girls. I just have to see where number of male and females. There were 81% males in the autistics and 45% in the controls.
So he didn't control for gender?
No, he doesn't control for gender.
Does lead concentration affect mercury tooth concentration?
What?
Lead concentration of a tooth affect its mercury concentration?
Does blood
lead? Does lead?
Lead?
Yes. Does lead tooth concentration affect mercury tooth concentration?
You're asking me whether lead concentration affects mercury concentration
in a tooth?
In the teeth?
Yes.
I don't know.
Do you know what type of mercury was measured in the teeth? Was it ethyl mercury or inorganic mercury?
I don't know whether he did speciation or not. Let's see. I don't think they did speciation, so I think he's doing total mercury.
Do levels of mercury in baby teeth reflect anything, tell you anything about the levels of mercury in the blood?
In the blood?
In the circulating blood.
I don't know. I would think it would depend on the particular genetic composition of the child, but I don't know the answer to your question.
Do mercury levels in the teeth tell you anything about the amounts of inorganic mercury in the brain?
I don't know whether there has been a correlative study along those lines. I don't think anyone has done the study.
The second piece of your pillar is the Holmes study.
Yes.
And that's on page 24 and 25 of your report, if that's helpful. in the Home Studies Petitioner's Master List 237. And the Home Study found that hair from autistic children contained less mercury than the controls. Is that correct?
That's correct, as I said in the report.
And then from that, do you conclude from this study that autistic children cannot excrete mercury?
That autistic children, I'm not sure what sentence you're talking about now.
I'm asking if it's your opinion, based on that study.
Yeah, I think this is one of the examples of there's less mercury being excreted into the hair in autistic children, which is an indication of more of it being staying in the tissues of autistic children as compared to controls.
What percentage of mercury gets excreted through the hair? What percentage of mercury?
Very small percent.
What percentage gets excreted through feces? Through the feces or through urine? Can you break that down?
The feces is a major source of, is a major route of the excretion of mercury.
How about urine?
Urine is a route if you use, well, first of all, urine, you can use urine as a measure of mercury exposure, of how much mercury is in the body. You can increase the mercury excretion in the urine by giving a chelating agent, like DMSA.
Were measurements of either feces or urine, mercury measurements taken in either feces or urine in the Holmes study?
No.
Did the Holmes study attempt to determine or control for mercury exposure in their test subjects before they took hair samples?
I'm sorry.
Did they control
excuse me, ma'am, okay. But if you would talk directly into the microphone, it would be a big help to me.
Did the Holmes study attempt to determine or control for mercury exposure in their test subjects before taking hair samples?
They just took hair samples, as far as I know. I have it. Again, I read that paper a number of times after it was published. I don't remember whether they did any interviews or anything else about mercury.
What studies have confirmed the Holmes study?
A study from the MIT group, which had a small number of children, but used an entirely different technique, is an example of the confirmation of the Holmes study.
And is that also known as the Hugh study, HU? Is that the Hugh study, HU, 2003?
Yes, it is.
How many autistic children were included in that study?
It was either two or three. It was a small number. I don't, if it's a, it's a small number.
And did the author of that paper control for dietary intake of mercury?
They state quite clearly that they did not.
And isn't it true that two of the three autistic subjects had undergone heavy metal detoxification prior to being tested?
If the paper says so, that's true.
And wouldn't dietary intake and mercury detoxification, wouldn't they be factors that would affect levels of mercury found in the hair?
It would cause more mercury to be found in the hair if the intoxication was for a lengthy period of time. But the hair, it depends on how the hair analysis was done, whether it was done in segments to correlate with time or it was a complete hair sample.
Are you aware of any papers that dispute the findings of Holmes?
We've quoted the IP paper as being incorrect, and we've quoted other paper. There are indications that people believe the Holmes paper makes sense now, especially after the reanalysis by, I want to say DeSoto is her name. I think it's DeSoto. It's from yesterday's is in the record.
Now, the IP study did not find a significant difference in mercury hair levels between autistics and non-autistics. Is that correct?
The IP study, I want to be certain we're quoting it correctly. But essentially, that's correct, as I recall it. But the point is that the DeSoto people pointed out they reanalyzed the data originally reported by IP et al. In 2004 and found the original p-values were in error and that a significant relation does exist between, they did blood levels and the diagnosis of an autism spectrum disorder. However, moreover, the hair sample analysis results offer some support for the idea that persons with autism may be less efficient and more variable at eliminating mercury from the blood.
Did the DeSoto article criticize the findings of the IP hair study or just the blood findings? Did it find the hair measures to be incorrect?
They criticized the blood levels.
And I've put up on the screen what DeSoto said about the hair levels.
You're not talking to the microphone. I'm sorry. Forgive me.
I put up on the screen what DeSoto said about the hair studies and the IP. It's on the screen, sir.
Oh.
It says there was no difference in the mean hair levels. This is essentially the same result as reported in the original article. So the DeSoto study doesn't dispute the hair findings of IP. Is that correct?
I would have to read the paper again very carefully. This statement implies that. I just don't remember this statement per se. However, could you go on to see what the however is? However, given that hair levels would be normally be expected to be higher carried blood, it might be surprising that blood levels could predict an autism spectrum disorder, but that hair mercury levels could not. Indeed, hair and mercury levels for the full sample were correlated.
Are you aware of the FIDO article, 2005, F-I-D-O?
Sorry.
And that's Respondent's Master List, Article 138. Are you familiar with that article?
Could you expand it for me? Oh, this is the article from Quate. And so I don't know how good these investigators are. There is no American investigator associated with this study. I don't know whether they use the proper techniques. I don't know. I'm not willing to give an opinion on this paper.
But did it dispute the findings of the Holmes study?
Pardon?
Did it dispute the findings in the Holmes study?
They dispute the findings in the Holmes study. Could you give me the journal reference? That's what I thought. Okay. I'm ready to go on.
How about the Kern study, 2007? And that's Respondent's Master List, number 274. Did the Kern study dispute the findings of the Holmes study?
I think it does dispute it.
And how about Adams 2006, Respondents Master List 2?
Well, let's read that abstract. I don't see in this particular abstract the word mercury, though I could miss it very, very easily. They've done iodine levels, chromium levels, potassium levels, zinc, lithium. I don't see in the abstract the word mercury. Again, I could be wrong. So what is the point of this article? Why are you bringing it up now?
Does it confirm the Holmes study then?
It doesn't try to confirm the Holmes study. As far as I can see, this article does not, as far as the abstract is concerned, does not mention mercury analysis of hair.
Are you familiar with the rest of the... I won't ask you to read the article, Doctor, so we will move on.
I'm just reading the abstract.
Okay, we'll move on. I want to turn to chelation now, which you use as chelation.
Yes,
these are the third and fourth pillars of your six pillars.
This is the Bradstreet Report, is that what you're referring to?
We'll start with the Bradstreet Report. And that report stated that autistic children treated with DSMA excreted more mercury than controls. Is that
yes.
correct?
They were comparing controls with autistic children.
What is DSMA? DMSA
is dimercaptosuccinic acid. It is a water-soluble, relatively non-toxic chelating agent that mobilizes metals such as lead, arsenic, and mercury. It is approved by the Federal Drug Administration for the treatment of children with blood lead levels of 45 micrograms per deciliter of blood or more, but it also has an off-label use for treating mercury intoxication and arsenic intoxication because its safety has been proven in children.
And it's fair to say that you've performed a significant number of chelation studies. Is that correct?
Bradstreet?
No, you.
Yes, that's correct.
And you've published several peer-reviewed articles on chelation. Is that correct?
Many.
Do you know how many articles you've published on DMSA chelation?
I have anywhere from 5 to 10, 20. I don't...
That's okay if you don't know, but several.
I just don't judge my productivity by numbers. I judge my productivity by quality of the papers in first-class peer-reviewed journals.
Have you ever published a peer-reviewed experimental study on chelation where you did not get both pre- and post-chelation measurements?
In most of our papers, I don't remember exactly how many. I think in most, but I also have shortcomings as almost most beginning investigators do when they enter a new field. We've usually always insisted on doing pre and post. Now, whether any of our early papers did not do pre-urinary mercury levels or heavy metal levels, I just don't remember.
And you testified in Cedillo that you always try to get a baseline. It's the proper way of doing a test. Is that correct?
It depends on what the purpose of the experiment or the study is. It depends on how easy it is to get patients. It's very difficult to just make a statement with no reservations. And if I said that at the time, then you have the quote, I said it. But let me say that we usually insist on doing pre and post, but we can understand with autistic children, those of us who have worked with autistic children, how difficult it is to get a blood sample and a urine sample, and to try to get two in the same day makes it very difficult to do the experiment.
So the Bradstreet study didn't take pre-chelation mercury levels, is that correct?
They did chelation, and they compared, not pre and post, but they compared a group of autistic children with a group of control children.
Did the Bradstreet study control for dietary intake of mercury?
I don't think so, but I don't recall. My impression is they did not. It's very difficult, especially with autistic children, to have that kind of control.
Could dietary intake affect post-chelation urine mercury levels?
Absolutely. If there was a great deal of mercury-containing foods in the diet.
Your fourth pillar is, and it's on page 25 of your report, you state, the most beneficial treatment for autism is reported by parents of autistic children was chelation therapy. And that's the fourth pillar of your six pillars. Do you recall that?
I recall something like that. Where is it on the... Is
page 25.
Page 25. Yes, I see it now, yes.
And you rely on the 2006 Autism Research Institute consensus paper addressing chelation.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. What was the question about that?
You rely on the consensus paper from the Autism Research Institute.
Essentially, I also, to some extent, but also relied a great deal on what parents told me at these think tank meetings or the meetings associated with think tank, although I realize the shortcomings of supposedly of taking parental views. It's not a controlled clinical trial.
Is the consensus paper, it's not a peer-reviewed paper, it's just a consensus paper issued by the...
It depends on how you define peer review. That consensus paper was given to at least 100 think tank members, of which maybe, at least, my guess is at least 20 peer reviewed it. I did not peer review it because I thought it would be a conflict of interest because of my interest in DMSA.
But it wasn't peer reviewed by a journal editor?
It was not published in a journal, is what you're saying.
Can you can you cite to any peer-reviewed journal articles that demonstrate chelation improves the neurological manifestations of autism?
Improves?
The neurological manifestations of autism.
I don't know whether... No, Bradstreet's was short-term. I know of no good paper that proves it. The NIH started such a study, but has, for a variety of reasons, abandoned the study.
Have any of the authors on the consensus paper done studies upon which to base their opinion, or peer-reviewed studies upon which to base their opinions that chelation is useful for the treatment of autism?
I honestly don't know. I just don't have the names of the reviewers before me.
Do you remember that Dr. Mumper was one of the authors on that paper?
I just don't remember.
Do you know whether Dr. Mumper performs chelation on patients? Do you know whether Dr. Mumper performs chelation?
Why don't you ask her? Because she'd be a witness. She's a very reliable physician, and I would hate to put. I would hate to misquote her.
Okay.
I think I know what she does, but I think since she is going to be an expert witness here, I would rather not make a statement.
Would you agree that by the time most autistic children are chelated, the chelator is removing inorganic mercury from the body?
When most autistic children have been chelated, what was the rest of it?
Is it removing inorganic mercury from the body?
Oh, may I rephrase a question? Are you asking me whether DMSA will stimulate the excretion of inorganic mercury and or methyl or ethyl mercury? Is that what you're asking me?
I'm asking you that by the time children undergo chelation therapies, which is after the vaccination schedule has been administered, is that usually correct?
Sorry, I don't understand your question.
Okay, I will ask you. What is DSMA removed from the body? What does it chelate? What kinds of mercury does it chelate? We'll go with your question.
Fine. You're asking what DMSA chelates.
Yes.
All right.
And mercury.
But fine. We're just talking about mercury.
Yes.
And let's be very specific about this. DMSA will chelate. By definition, chelate means forms a ring with mercuric mercury. It will not chelate methylmercury, but it will cause the increased excretion of methylmercury because DMSA will tie up two individual molecules of methylmercury and will not form the chelate. So that's why we, many of us, prefer to use the term metal mobilizing agent rather than chelating agent. Is that clear, ma'am?
Yes.
Thank you.
But when you chelate autistic children, what are you removing from the body? Is it mostly inorganic mercury?
I think it would. I don't know whether anyone has actually done that study, but in animal studies that we and other people have done, I think we've done it anyway, Clarkson has done both human and others, one would expect that both organic mercury and inorganic mercury would be, the excretion of both of them would be increased in the urine.
What did Bradstreet measure in the urine when he chelated?
I think he did total mercury. I'm not positive, but my guess is that since the laboratory did not do speciation, my guess is he did total mercury, but I don't know.
No. And where is most of that mercury coming from when you chelate?
Where does mercury come from when you give DMSA?
Yes.
The majority of the mercury would come from the kidney. But from animal experiments that we've done, we also get mercury from other tissues in the body.
Now, you testified earlier that once inorganic mercury is in the brain, it stays there for a very long time. Is that correct?
That is what Vater and other people have published.
And you have also performed chelation studies on animals to determine whether chelation removes mercury from the brain. Is that correct?
We have performed chelation studies in animals that have been exposed to mercury vapor and have been able to show that DMSA did not remove mercury from the brain. That's your question, and that's the answer.
It did not remove inorganic mercury.
We did not do speciation, as I remember. We did total mercury.
And the paper, the consensus paper from the Autism Research Institute, also says chelation does not lower brain mercury levels. Is that correct?
That's not correct if you just say the word chelation. In studies that we are now writing up, we clearly show that a chelating agent called D-penicillamine that Clarkson used in Iraq also for treatment of humans, that D-penicillamine does decrease brain mercury.
What kind of mercury in the brain? Inorganic or organic?
I'm trying to think. We have done speciation, and right off the... It will reduce both, but it reduces one of them much more than the other. And I think it reduces the organic mercury in the brain brings much more organic mercury out than it does inorganic, although it will bring some inorganic mercury out. That's D-penicillamine.
And what paper is that? What are you citing? What is the basis for that?
That's studies that we have been doing for the last 2 years in my own laboratory, and we are in the process of writing up for publication now.
Does DMSA remove organic mercury, inorganic mercury from the brain?
DMSA will not remove any metal from the brain, but penicillamine will.
So if it's your hypothesis that autism is caused by inorganic mercury building up in the brain, how is chelation beneficial if it doesn't alter brain inorganic mercury levels?
Well, if there's mercury in the intestines, if there's mercury in other tissues in the body, those mercury levels can interrupt or inhibit the function of certain enzymes in those tissues. No one claims that we're only just dealing with the brain when you do chelation work, because most clinicians that use it know that if they give DMSA, it's not going to affect brain mercury. And also you must keep in mind that the damage to the brain probably has been made and it may not be reversible by the mercury.
So how do these? How does it improve neurological function? If the
did I say it improved neurological function? Did I say DMSA improves neurological function?
Is it? Do you believe it does?
Pardon?
Do you believe it does? Do you believe chelation with DMSA,
Yes.
can improve neurological function in autistic children?
Did I say that?
I'm asking you for your opinion.
I think you should ask Dr. Mumper that, because she has much more experience using chelating agents and dealing with autistic children.
But it's one of your pillars. I mean, it's one of the six pillars that you say leads you to believe that vaccines cause autism.
Do I say that DMSA cured autism? No, I don't say that.
No, chelation was beneficial.
I said that parents believe it's beneficial when DMSA was given to the children. A long list, a questionnaire was given to parents by the Autism Research Institute. And a long list of possible, does vitamin B6, does thyroxine, a whole bunch of things. What was consistent to almost 68% or whatever the figure is that I quote was that parents came up with DMSA. Now, no question, this is not a controlled, epidemiologically suitable clinical trial. We're just reporting what was said.
I know you said that chelation isn't FDA approved. It has has an off-label. You said it has an off-label use for the...
Not chelation. I said DMSA.
DSMA.
DMSA has an off-label use for treating mercury intoxication or to mobilizing mercury, and mobilizing arsenic. It has been used and published in peer-reviewed medical journals for those purposes. And the FDA approves a drug now for efficacy and safety. So off-label use usually means that the physician knows it's safe to use. The physician may not know how effective it will be in off-label use.
Do you disagree, then, with the Institute of Medicine's 2004 conclusion? And we can put that up. That because it is unlikely to remove mercury from the brain, chelation is useful only for immediately after exposure and before damage has occurred.
I don't see anything about the brain here. It says because chelation therapy has potential serious risk. Look, now you've changed it. We may not be looking at the same thing, ma'am.
We'll start.
Okay, here we are now.
Because it is unlikely to remove mercury from the brain, chelation is useful only immediately after exposure and before damage has occurred. Moreover, chelation therapy has serious risks. For example, some chelation therapies might cause the release of mercury from soft tissue stores, thus leading to increased exposure of the nervous system to mercury. Because chelation therapy has potentially serious risks, the committee recommends that it be used only in carefully controlled research settings with appropriate oversight by the institutional review boards protecting the interests of children who participate. Do you agree or disagree with that statement?
I don't completely agree with it. I am governed by an institutional review board in all the human experiments I do. And I have had a very firm connection with established medicine. However, when I see that someone improves, even though I'm not convinced that the improvement may be due to the drug that he's getting or she's getting or the placebo effect, if the child gets better, in the case of someone in my own family, that when something was given, the person got better. And so I don't give a darn whether it was recommended or not recommended by established medicine. So if we can go through these sentences one by one, I'll point out to you some of the problems with the sentences. And there are just three or four sentences. Because it is unlikely to remove mercury from the brain, chelation is useful only immediately after exposure and before damage has occurred. Now, first of all, there are now chelating agents. We've had chelating agents that will remove mercury from the brain. British anti-lewisite, the name for it, the official name is dimercaprol. It will remove mercury from the brain. But when it's first given during the first couple of days, it will cause a redistribution of mercury. It will take mercury from the tissues, and that chelate, it's a true chelate, will be moved up the brain and cross the blood-brain barrier. So British anti-lewisite dimercaprol is no longer recommended for the treatment of heavy metal poisoning because for the first couple of days it will increase the levels. All right? So there is, but in the long run, the brain mercury level does go down, but you could do some damage. So the first sentence isn't completely truthful, all right? But moreover, chelation therapy has serious risks. That's absolutely correct. For example, some chelation therapies might cause a release of mercury from soft tissue stores, thus leading to increased exposure of the nervous system to mercury. That statement is also correct. Because chelation therapy has potential serious risks, the committee recommends that it be used only in carefully controlled research settings with appropriate oversight by institutional research boards protecting the interests of children who participate. I cannot disagree with that as an academic. However, when I hear and meet parents who say, I got my child back a tremendous improvement if they're given DMSA, even though there's no controlled study, I can't ignore that. And I can't ignore the fact that some children are given DMSA and it did not help them. So I don't know what you're asking me now about this. As a research person, I certainly agree with the last statement. But I'm not treating a human being. I'm doing research. And Dr. Mumper could probably address that more clearly.
The fifth pillar for arguing thimerosal-containing vaccines cause autism is the Hornig study. Do you still rely on the Hornig study as one of your pillars?
That's a very difficult question now because some people have claimed that they can't repeat it. But according to Grapevine, she is now coming up with another study that will. So I just, at the present time, I have no firm opinion.
And you are referring to the Berman study, which is Respondents Master List 42. They tried to replicate the Hornig study and could not. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And I think I have it in the list of slides that we showed, actually. So what do you want to ask about the Berman study?
I have no questions on the Berman study other than it tried to replicate the Hornig study and could not. Is that a fair assessment of that, of the Berman study?
But there's
study?
Also criticism of the Berman study.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you about the criticisms unless...
You're not going to ask?
No.
All right. Thank you.
Your sixth pillar... You state, and that's on page 25 of your report, the sixth pillar.
Page 25.
And that is that there's evidence of postnatal loss of brain cells in autism, particularly in the cerebellum. What's the basis for that statement?
I thought it was, that's mentioned here, Korshness 203 at page 584 and reference cited there. But that's all I know at this present time.
Do you know whether that article discusses the possibility of thimerosal as a cause of autism?
I don't frankly even remember reading the article. I don't know when I read it, so I just have to familiarize myself with the title of the article, and maybe I can answer your question. I don't recall thimerosal as being part of that article, but I'm not certain.
If we take out the Hornig study, which you're not sure about anymore, how many of these pillars do you need? You said taken individually, that doesn't matter, but if you take them all together, it shows that vaccine, thimerosal-containing vaccines can cause autism. What if we take away two pillars? Well, what three studies or two studies? How many pillars do you need, I guess?
As many as I can find.
What if we only had one pillar?
It depends on the quality of the paper and whether I believe what they did and whether I have any confidence in what the investigator has done in the past and what the peer-reviewed critiques are.
But you said taken alone, you really couldn't draw that conclusion. But taken together, you could.
In these papers, I certainly feel better after having more than one pill, as you put it.
How about two?
I don't understand the purpose of the question. The more we have, the better off we are. The more evidence we have, the more convincing it is. If you have one piece of evidence, it's one piece. If you have two pieces of evidence, then it should be twice as good.
Did you put these pillars in order of what you think are the most important studies that show thimerosal-containing vaccines cause autism? Is there a particular order?
I really put them in the order of their importance as to the connection of mercury with autism. I did not have in mind in any of these the use of thimerosal as vaccines at the time when I put these in order.
Dr. Poshin, yesterday in your testimony, and I only have a black and white copy, but as I recall, you stated that the parts...
Give me the slide number.
All of your slides. We're going to do, it's a general question. Oh. You said some of it was written in blue and some of it was written in red.
Yes.
What did the blue represent again?
The blue was either a direct quotation or what if you read the article, you could understand the author was saying. It was, in some cases, my abstract of that article, but it was what the author was saying. That was the blue. The red was my expert opinion, and I tried to keep those separate as best as I could.
Now, you wrote your report in August of 2007. Is that correct?
If that's what the date is...
And I know you testified yesterday that following the completion of your report, you had health problems in your family that sort of distracted you from focusing on this litigation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
When did you start refocusing on this litigation?
The word focus is not a good term.
Okay.
I've always thought about it.
When did you begin working on this case towards litigation, reworking on this case?
I just don't recall. My guess is it was always in my mind, and I was always thinking about it. One doesn't just put things out of their mind. Anyway, it's not possible for me put something completely out of my mind.
But when did you actually, you don't recall when you actually started working on it again, preparing for your testimony?
We have the figures. If it's really important, I have an invoice I can check. Would you like that?
Well, was it a month ago? 2 weeks ago?
I would guess at least probably, my guess is December, January, something around that time. Since this is court of law, I don't want to say something that's not...
I'm not asking for an exact date, so okay. We don't need to look at your invoice. I was okay. Just wondering.
All right.
So you think December, January of sometime?
That's what my guess is, but I really don't know.
And in your testimony yesterday, you cited quite a few articles that weren't in your initial report. Is that correct?
Did I...
You referred to articles that were not in your initial report.
Yes,
is that
that's correct.
And one of those articles, for example, you relied on was DeSiccio, Bloom et al. It's an article from 2006. And we'll show you your slide.
Yes.
What's that article about?
Can you put it back on?
Well, you testified to it yesterday.
But
let's see what you can.
You just had it on the article for me to look at. May I ask the courtesy?
Well, we'll put it up. But what I'd like to ask you first: what do you recall about that article before we put it up?
I recall it being a very good and clear article that I emailed to a number of people recommending that they should read it. Some of my associates at the University of Arizona and at other universities. It explained a great deal about autism in relatively simple language that I and many people who are not MDs might understand. That's what I remember about the article. And that's why I have slides which quote them directly. And if I can go to, I think that's, you have, thank you, sir. And I now have it in front.
And we're referring to slide 77.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much, Special Master.
How did you find this article?
Can I find 77 first?
I'm sorry.
Please.
It's right up on the screen.
I still would prefer seeing my own slide. Thank you. Yes. Okay. Now, what is your question, please?
How did you find out about this article? I mean, it obviously was published prior to you writing your report, but how did you find this article subsequent to writing your report?
Let me tell you how I usually work so that we can be clear and so I don't have to, you know, say I don't know or something. One reads an article, and as one reads the article, one reads a statement with a reference. And if that statement is important, then one wants to go back and check that reference to see whether what the person is quoting in the article is really correct. And so I suspect that in this case, the DeSiccio Bloom article, I picked up because I read some article and suddenly the developmental of neurobiology of autism spectrum disorder appeared in the reference list. And therefore, I went to my abstracting service, which is Highwire Press that Stanford University puts out, and immediately got the article. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Now, you didn't think this article was important when you wrote your initial report. Is that correct?
I'm not even certain I knew it existed. I don't know whether you're implying it's not in my initial report, so I would suspect that I didn't even know it existed. I had less than a month to put this report together when I take much more time to very thoroughly and carefully do things.
I understand that, and that's not what I'm asking. I'm just asking why, subsequent to your report, you found this article important to rely on.
Because neurobiology is basic to autism spectrum disorders. Developmental neurobiology is even more basic, and so the title intrigued me. And I read it to learn more about developmental neurobiology of autism spectrum disorders. I don't know everything, and the more I can learn, if by reading good peer-reviewed scientific articles, the better off my knowledge is.
Did you find this article before or after you read Dr. Kinsborn's report?
Before I read?
Dr. Kinsborn's report.
I don't remember, to tell the truth. I don't know. I was very impressed by Dr. Kinsborn's report. Is this in his report?
Well, we can ask Dr. Kinsborn about his report. I don't know. I just want to know why you relied on it. If you relied on it post seeing Dr. Kinsborn's report,
the answer is I don't know, but I doubt it. I try to stay independent of other people's reports in a given case.
Did you create all the slides for your presentation yesterday yourself?
As far as I know, I did. The only time I used some help from my young students was if I could not transfer a picture, a photograph from a journal to PowerPoint, which sometimes is very difficult for me. And so then I call one of my students on the telephone and tell her, her name is Emily Goldberg, and she does it so nicely.
So you wrote all of the parts in blue yourself?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I type with my fingers. It's not the easiest thing.
No, the only reason I was asking, and we'll pull up a slide.
I'm sorry.
Which is slide four.
I think this slide was put together from material that I gave the law office.
Okay, so the fact that you refer to your laboratory as his laboratory. So those are pre-existing slides that you put in.
I think so.
I have no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Renzi.
Do we have questions now, or do you want to wait? I have a couple of questions, Dr. Fosian.
Yes, ma'am.
Dr. Posian, are you aware of any estimates of the average daily intake, and I hesitate to use that word, of mercury in any of all species in humans?
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry I didn't show that because I had gathered that I should not repeat very much from the Cedillo trial.
This is a separate theory, a separate case, doctor.
Pardon?
This is a separate theory, a separate case. We're not incorporating your testimony from Cedillo into this case that I'm aware of.
In the Cedillo slides, and if you want, I can bring it up because I think I have that talk here. There is and it's published in the, I think it's called the Toxicology of Methylmercury, the National Research Council publication 2007 and in the year 200, I think, 2000, I think, and in the World Health Organization. There is a wonderful table that lists the species of mercury with the intake of each one for the general population and also the retention. The greatest exposure of the general population to mercury in general, without speciation now, is the mercury from amalgams. Of course, that exposure is mercury vapor. Okay? And of that, if I remember correctly, it's in the ballpark of 6 to 10 micrograms per day. Of course, depending on how many amalgams you have and that sort of thing, but that's the average. It's a wonderful table, and if our lawyers will remind me, or if you give me your email, I will be happy to email it to you. It's published in the article in the toxicology chapter that I wrote for the NRC monograph.
So it's available and we could obtain it.
Pardon?
So it is available.
Absolutely.
And we could obtain it.
And would you like more information now?
Certainly.
Okay. The of all the species of mercury, the organic mercury they're talking now about is methylmercury, that's the far right-hand side, that of all the exposures to mercury, we retain most of the methylmercury that we're exposed to, all right? And the inorganic mercury, the mercuric mercury, if you will, as far as the general population is concerned, you're exposed to a little bit of it in food, but it's generally considered to be of very low value. So to summarize, the greatest exposure of the general population to mercury is via dental amalgam mercury, that the methylmercury of them all, methylmercury is retained the most, and it's in the order of, I think, 6 to 20 micrograms per day that you retain. And the inorganic mercury is sort of insignificant.
All right. Now, if we're dealing with children from birth to age 3, understanding that those children receive some exposure to mercury from the dental amalgams of their mother, is there a different table or a different assessment of an average daily exposure?
No, ma'am, there is not. There's not one that I know of, because this question came up at our NRC meetings. The closest thing you can find is the Seychelles Island and the Faroe Island and the New Zealand studies, but it's not in table form at all. It just gives an idea about low exposure of children to methylmercury in fish or in whales. But we don't have a table like we have for the general population.
You also referred in your testimony to some of the findings of in the brains of primates and the brains of autopsied autistic subjects. Are there any studies you are aware of that measure the brain mercury level of in autopsy of autistic subjects?
Oh, yes. Let me be sure I have the question right. You're asking me, are there any studies that have measured the mercury levels in the brains of autistic children?
That is correct.
Yes, there
Or adults. Autistic children or adults.
Of autistics, yes. There are such studies.
And did you cite any of them either in your presentation or your paper?
I thought I did, but the cross-examination was so good, my thoughts quite... I'm quite concentrated, but let me very quickly, if I can. I think there's one from, I'm positive, there's one from Hopkins. Put my finger on it. I'm not positive, but I would suggest that one look at a paper by Vargas et al. I'm not positive. That would be, it's slide 79.
Thank you. I will look at that.
If it's not that one, and if I find one, I'll try to tell.
Bring it up to the attorneys, and they can bring it up to us at a later time.
My apologies for not being able to come up with it right away.
That's not a problem. No one expects that. I'm just trying to get the questions answered while we have you here.
All right.
You also mentioned yesterday in talking about thimerosal and ethyl mercury, you seem to equate thimerosal with methylate. Was I misunderstanding what you said, or is that correct?
I think that's correct.
And when we're talking about methylate, we're talking about that topical antiseptic
that
you
stuff.
And I were probably painted with as children. But
did you say anesthetic or
antiseptic?
Yeah, antiseptic, yes.
Yes. Yeah, it certainly wasn't an anesthetic, as
that's
I would
right.
call it.
All right. And so, that has been prohibited now.
Prohibited now. But at the time you and I were children, and some of the people under over 40 in this room were, it was fairly common
yes.
in use as an anesthetic.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And that would also refer to mercurochrome. I think chrome was another formulation of that.
Yes, ma'am. Right.
And then finally, just I got a bit confused as during the cross-examination. So let me make sure I understand what you're saying. The Marisol is injected. It is converted by the body rapidly to ethyl mercury. And then the ethyl mercury at some point is, and I've forgotten the term, but it is converted to mercuric.
Yeah, it enters mercury. The tissues.
It enters tissue.
And then it's de-ethylated.
De-ethylated.
Yes,
okay,
ma'am.
De-ethylated as opposed to demethylated, which is what happens with methyl mercury.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. It is de-ethylated to mercuric mercury.
Mercuric mercury.
And that is the form of mercury that persists in the brain.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and it doesn't matter whether it comes from ethyl or methyl mercury.
Correct.
Except that more ethyl mercury is converted to mercuric mercury in the brain.
A greater percentage.
A greater percentage. All right.
I'm sorry, let's be careful. There's a greater percentage of the total mercury.
Correct.
That becomes mercuric mercury in the case of ethyl mercury exposure.
All right. Now, my question is, is it mercuric mercury in the brain that you are contending is what causes autism? The mercuric mercury in the brain? Is that correct?
Yes. Of course, we cannot rule out that some of the organic mercury is also doing it, but the mercuric mercury is what stays there and stays there for a long time, and the mercuric mercury has an extremely high affinity for the enzymes of the brain that have sulfhydryl group. The methyl mercury is too big to get into certain enzymes that have an SH group.
But once it's demethylated and becomes mercuric mercury, it doesn't matter how it got
Once it becomes demethylated, then it can go in as a mercuric ion and inhibit an enzyme.
All right. Those are my questions. Any redirect, Mr. Williams?
Yes. Thank you.
Dr. Posian, I want to start by going over the DeSoto criticism of the IP study and the analysis of the hair data from that study. You were shown on Cross the first DeSoto paper criticizing IP, but you weren't shown the second DeSoto paper that responded to Dr. Ashner's letter about the hair analysis. Do you recall that? Let me put that up. This is petitioner's Exhibit 612.
You're making it bigger for me, Scott.
You show the title first, Scott, just so they... Just to remind the special masters, IP did a study comparing the blood levels and the hair levels of mercury in autistic children and controls. And the first paper published by IP said there was no difference. And it was interpreted as therefore a negative study on whether there was this efflux disorder, correct? But then DeSoto and colleague published a reanalysis of the IP data that concluded there was a statistical significant difference between the autistic children, the blood levels in the autistic children of mercury, and the blood in the controls. That was where it was higher in the autistics, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, yes. And then Dr. Ashner wrote a letter to the editor, which is what we have up on the screen here now, and I want to show what his criticism was of the DeSoto.
Actually, counsel,
yeah.
Are you going to pose a question?
I mean, I understand background, but it's going on quite... Do you have a question to pose to the witness?
Yeah, I'm going to... I can ask you...
Let's direct your queries up here, okay? Rather than engaging in colloquy among counsel. Please address your inquiries to the bench, or your objections to the bench. Mr. Williams, I do think you need to get to a question, however.
Okay. Did Dr. Ashner write a letter to the editor of the journal criticizing the DeSoto reanalysis of the IP data?
Yes, sir.
And I've highlighted a section that I believe summarizes. Let me ask you, does this highlighted portion here, does that summarize what Dr. Ashner is criticizing DeSoto's reanalysis for?
That's not necessarily so.
No, I'm just asking you, is this what Dr. Ashner was arguing?
Yes.
Yes. And then DeSoto and Hitlin, did they write a response to Ashner's letter that starts on the second column of this same paper?
What? Yes, they wrote an answer.
Okay, and now if we go to the second page of their reanalysis, I've highlighted some sections that I want to ask you about. The first one is, it says here that a case in point of apparent misunderstanding is this letter by Ashner. And they quote his criticism. And then they say, we believe it should be clear that our conclusion was not related to the hair analysis, and the statement by Ashner appears to reflect a misunderstanding of our article. Now, toward the bottom of this page, they start reanalyzing the hair analysis data, and that's what I want to ask you about. It says, there's a paragraph that says the hair analysis data. I'm going to pull it up here. You see where they say the hair analysis data is in fact interesting, but it is of secondary importance. That said, because it was brought up in Ashner's critique, we address the rest of his criticism. And he goes on, they reiterate his criticism, which is, can you explain what his criticism was again about the chelation therapy?
He says that chelation therapy and changes in the diet and fish consumption both most likely to occur in the ASD group, supposedly, in the 2 months preceding the mercury analysis, are likely to affect blood and but not hair mercury.
Okay. Then on the start of the next column, on the second half of this page, would you read what they say there about whether they agree with Ashner's critique or not?
To some, chelation among autistic patients could, as Ashner suggests, cause a correlation between blood and hair to be different in the autistic group compared in controls. So do we agree with Ashner's critique? No.
And then I've highlighted a section just a little bit lower on that same page where they start to explain why they disagree with Ashner. Could you read that, and then I may have some questions to ask you about that.
In other words, the autistic sample had lower hair levels of mercury than their blood levels would predict, and not the higher levels as would be the case if they had undergone successful chelation therapy. They are consistent with the idea that the autistic sample might perhaps be worse at ridding the body of circulating mercury, and not consistent with the idea that the autistic group might have recently experienced a high level of mercury removal from blood circulation than controls.
So what are they saying here now about the hair levels and the chelation criticism of Dr. Ashner?
They're not agreeing with Ashner's criticisms, and they say they're consistent with the idea that autistics might perhaps be not good at ridding the body, or may have an efflux, if you will, disorder.
So is it fair to say that the current state of this back and forth about IP's data on hair that DeSoto and
Hintner, I think it
Kaplan,
is,
interpret the hair analysis to be consistent with your theory that autistic children have a mercury efflux disorder that you can see in their hair analysis.
It is consistent.
Now I want to turn to the teeth paper by Adams.
Mm-hmm.
This is Petitioner's Exhibit 138. You were asked quite a few questions about this this morning. And what I want to go to, what you were asked is whether this was indicative of a body burden, whether the additional, just to summarize, the tooth study found that in autistic children, there was more mercury in their teeth than in the controls. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And you were asked whether that was indicative of a body burden or not, right?
Correct.
Well, let's see what the authors say about that. If you look at the second page, middle of the first column, I've highlighted a sentence about that. What did the authors of this paper say about that, whether this reflects a body burden or not?
A decreased ability to excrete mercury should result in a higher body burden.
And then on the right-hand side of this paper, this right-hand column, would you read what we've highlighted there about baby teeth studies?
Baby teeth are formed in utero, and during the first few years of life, so they provide a measure of cumulative exposure during that critical period of development. Previous studies have demonstrated that mercury can be reliably measured in teeth.
And do you agree with those statements by these?
Absolutely. Yes.
And then finally, over in their discussion section on page 1049 of the article, the first sentence of the discussion, I'll ask you to read that, please, as we blow it up here.
The 2 to 3-fold higher level of mercury in the baby teeth of children with autism is important because it strongly suggests that they had a higher body burden of mercury during several years of prenatal / infant development.
And do you agree with that interpretation of the data?
I do agree.
Then on the last page of the article, start with the paragraph on the bottom left. Would you read that, please, and then I'll ask you some questions about it.
It is interesting to note that the median mercury level in controlled teeth was 50 parts per billion, which is similar to the level of mercury, 40 to 50 parts per billion, found by Burbacher et al. 2005 in the brains of infant monkeys following dosing of the monkeys with thimerosal in a manner designed to mimic the U.S. childhood vaccination schedule. If baby teeth levels correlate with brain levels, then this suggests that the children with autism in this small study had median brain levels of mercury in the range of 140 parts per billion, which is approaching the range of what has previously been calculated as necessary to result in mercury-induced neurological disorders by Takush and Ito, 1975.
In fact, I want to show you the very next sentence, too, of this that I didn't highlight, but it's the last sentence of that paragraph, if you could just pull that up, Scott. Just read one more sentence, please.
They found that levels of 260 to 630 parts per billion were able to induce Minamata disease, which was a severe form of mercury poisoning.
All right. And then again, do you agree with this interpretation of their teeth data and Burbacher's data?
I do. Yes.
And then their conclusion. There's a two-sentence conclusion of the paper. I'll have you read that.
The results of this small study suggest that children with autism have a higher body burden of mercury, probably due to a decreased ability to excrete mercury that is likely in part due to a high usage of oral antibiotics.
And do you agree with that statement?
Yes, I do, sir.
Now, you were also asked some questions about the 2004 IOM report. And I just want to show you some the references to this 2004 IOM report for a moment. Could you blow the references up, Scott? Thank you. First of all, do you note that the IOM committee cites you as one of the authorities they have consulted in writing this report? Is that you? Is that your name there?
That is my name, sir.
Okay. But then let's look to see if this IOM 2004 report cites any of the adult monkey studies that were published back in the mid-1990s that we spent quite a bit of time with yesterday.
Charleston and Vader.
Charleston and Vader. Let's see if there's any Charleston papers in the citations to this 2004 IOM report. Did you pull up the C's, Scott? We lost the citation page. Just blow up the, well, you blow up the difference between this. Yeah, that's where it is. So there's a Chen and a Comey, but there's no Charleston paper cited, right?
That's correct.
Okay, let's go to the V section of the citations. And let's see if any of the Vader papers are cited. You need to show the one above that, Scott. So we have Verstraten. We have Verricchio. We have Ullman. But there's no Vader papers cited there, are there?
There are none, sir.
Do you know how the IOM austere committee could have overlooked those adult monkey studies from the mid-1990s?
You want my opinion, sir?
Yes.
The problem with that committee was there is no toxicologist, no biochemist, no physiologist, no one who deals with toxicity per se. This committee was almost completely made up of epidemiologists who study or vaccine people. There's a gross in all the IOM reports that have been published about vaccine safety. There have been no toxicologists, certainly in this one, and the one that I attended with that committee, no toxicologists who would be an expert, or no biochemist who would be an expert on how methylmercury and thimerosal and inorganic mercury would affect a child.
Now, I'm going to represent to you that there's no discussion of neuroinflammation in that 2004 IOM report in relation to autism. Would that surprise you?
I have not read the complete report, but that is a shock to me, really, because it's just a shock. The Zimmerman work is going to be classic, and I would suspect that if he continues, he'll probably get a Nobel Prize.
Now, I want to show and go to your report for a moment, the one from last year, and look quickly just to see some of the topics that you had in your report that you have not been cross-examined about. Let's turn to page 13. You see the topic, just blow up the bottom paragraph there, Scott, number 5, the brain and mercury. Now, here you're analyzing the Burbacher and Pichichero numbers. If we go to the top of the next page of your report, explain what you're doing, what you were doing there when these calculations.
We were trying to estimate, and it is an estimate, of the amount of mercury in the brains of these children. And we had to, it was a very tricky thing, so tricky that I had to go ask another toxicologist, a superb toxicologist who just got a prize from our society, whether it made sense to him what I was doing because of the assumptions that were being made. And essentially, what we were trying to do was to find out how much mercury was in the brain after the thimerosal vaccinations.
And my recollection is you weren't cross-examined about this analysis at all. Is that your memory also?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, also on this page, same page 14, do you have a section of your report entitled Neuroinflammation in Autism?
Yes, sir.
And you cite the Pardo paper, the review in 2005 at the bottom of that?
Yes.
And then on the next page, you talk about the Connors twin study on terbutaline.
Yes.
And later I'll show that you went into the animal model. In fact, we can jump to that right here just a second. No one asked you any cross-examination questions about the Connors paper or terbutaline model, did they?
That's correct. No one asked me about terbutaline. Very important paper, a very important concept.
And
these are papers coming from mostly the Johns Hopkins group, and they've done very, very good work.
Your Honor, this time I will properly address my observations to you. Typically, redirect is about the matters that have been gone over on cross. Just because we haven't referred to a matter in the report doesn't mean we don't believe it's important or that we won't cover it. I'm not going to object to Mr. Powers or Mr. Williams going through parts of the report we didn't cover that perhaps Dr. Pashian didn't cover yesterday because it would be enlightening to us about what parts of the report are important to his opinion. However, if this is just argument about what respondent didn't ask in cross, then this is not the time to argue one's case.
Mr. Williams?
I think it's proper in redirect to point out areas of his testimony and his report which were ignored by the cross, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Okay. Remember that you're not pitching this to a jury. You're pitching it to three people who've read these reports.
Okay. And you can also argue this on brief, too.
Okay. Then I'll turn to one last topic, and that is the Pardo paper itself that you cited in your report, in which you were asked some questions about on cross. It's Petitioner's Exhibit 72. Let's show the title first, please, Scott. This is the 2005 Pardo review paper, right?
Yes. Very good paper.
The first thing I want to ask you about is on page 4 of this exhibit, where there's a section of the paper called Infections and Autism. Could you read the first sentence of that section, please?
Infections have been associated with autism in small numbers of children and include prenatal rubella, parentheses, Chess Fernandez, and Korn, 1978, end of parentheses, and cytomegalovirus, parentheses, Sweeten et al., 2003, Yamashita et al., 2003, end of parentheses, and postnatal herpes encephalitis, DeLong, Bean, and Brown, 1981, end of parentheses.
Now, but when they cite postnatal herpes encephalitis as a cause of autism here, is that consistent with your conception that there are postnatal insults that can lead to neuroinflammation and autism?
Yes, sir.
Then on page 6 of the Pardo review, It's the very middle of this paragraph, Scott, here, below the figure. You can pull that up. Let me read this to you because it's hard for me. Does it say in here that neuroglial activation in autism may be part of responses that result from disturbances of neuroglial function or neuronal neuroglial interactions during brain development and secondary extrinsic effects resulting from unknown factors that disturb postnatal CNS development? Does the paper say that?
That does say. Yes, sir.
And is that consistent with your general theory that is the inorganic mercury postnatally inducing neuroinflammation leading to autism?
Yes, sir.
And then at the very bottom of this column, at the and the very top of the next column, does this paper also say that a potential explanation of the CNS dysfunction in neuroinflammation is extrinsic etiological factors, non-genetic, neurotoxic, or environmental, involved in the pathogenesis of autism that can produce neuronal and cortical abnormalities to which neuroglial reactions are only secondary responses? You see that?
Yes, I see it now. I'm reading it slowly because it just didn't come up until a few seconds. Yes, I see that, sir.
And is that consistent with your notion that the extrinsic factor of inorganic mercury in the brain can lead to these problems?
Yes, sir.
And then finally, on the last page of the paper, in their conclusions, if you blow up just the top half of that conclusions paragraph, Scott, this is on page 9 of the exhibit. Well, you have it highlighted, part of it highlighted already. It says, well, let me ask you to read what I've highlighted there, Doctor.
We hypothesize, and you have to give me more of a view, Scott, please. I need the complete sentence. Thank you. We still don't, yes, we have just about it, yeah.
That's good.
We hypothesize that environmental factors, for example, neurotoxins, infections, maternal infections, in presence of genetic susceptibility and the immunogenetic background of the host, influence the development of abnormalities in cortical organization and neuronal circuitry and neuroinflammatory changes responsible for the generation of autistic symptoms.
And when they say that neurotoxins can be responsible for the generation of autistic symptoms, is that consistent with your notion that inorganic mercury is the cause in some cases?
Yes, sir.
And then let's look at figure 4 quickly, the last thing I want to ask you about. Let's blow up figure 4 that they just referred to. Over on the left, they have a balloon there for environmental toxins.
Yes, sir. I have it.
You see that?
Yes.
And what does the arrow point to from the environmental toxins that goes around the top over to the middle?
The central nervous system, neuronal organization, synapse and neurotransmitters, neuroglial activation. And you can go on to CNS, cytokines, etc.
All right. And then at the very bottom of this diagram, over in the right-hand corner, you see where it says autistic phenotype?
Yes.
What's the first word under autistic phenotype?
Regression.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Redirect.
Just a couple questions. Could we pull that slide back up, please?
Dr. Poshin, I just have a couple of questions
for
you. In 2004, you presented to the IOM. Is that correct? They invited you to present? 2004 IOM.
I think that. I don't keep dates straight, but I think it was 2004.
And you presented your theory that autism was caused by a mercury efflux disorder. Is that a fair summary of your presentation?
I think that's quite correct.
And you stated today you were very surprised that the Charleston and the Vauder paper were not presented to that IOM. Is that correct?
It was not listed as one of the articles, one of the papers in the bibliography that was shown.
So you didn't present the Charleston article in 2004?
You must realize that I was told I could speak for a short period of time, and I thought it was much more important to bring up the Wilson's disease model than do a complete survey
of all the work that many good people had done.
And you didn't present the Vader article either, did you?
The viral article?
Vader.
Vader, no, but she's a very good friend of mine. I've known her work. We just didn't have time to go into all of that.
You just presented your theory on mercury efflux. Is that correct?
I don't no. I'm sure there was introductory material and other theories, but one of the major point was to present the mercury efflux theory.
Did you discuss neuroinflammation with the IOM?
I did not, because my knowledge of neuroinflammation at that time was practically non-existent.
Did the IOM... Didn't the IOM reject your hypothesis that autism was caused by a mercury efflux disorder?
I really don't know. I don't know that.
Okay. I just want to turn to this chart for a minute that Mr. Williams asked you to look at. It's on your screen, that chart?
Yes.
And they call this hypothetical interactions of environmental and genetic factors. So how do postnatal insults lead to neuroinflammation? What's the mechanism? What's the process?
How does postnatal
insult
an environmental insult
lead to neuroinflammation?
I would much rather have our neurologist answer that later on.
So you don't know?
I think I know, but since it's a court of law, I just don't want to make a mistake in saying what I think. So I would rather pass it on to the neurologist.
But you offered your opinion today that you agree with this Pardo hypothesis. That's correct, and
I agree with the Pardo hypothesis.
But you don't understand why.
I have to be an expert in every single part of the hypothesis.
But you have an understanding of the mechanism of how this occurs that you can accept this hypothesis.
In my own mind, I have such a mechanism, which I'm not confident in presenting in public.
So it's not one you could articulate to the court at this moment.
Pardon?
It's not one you could articulate to the court today.
It's not one that I can be absolutely 100% certain that I would be giving the correct information at this time.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
All right. It would appear to be an appropriate time. I understand Dr. Opposi needs to leave this afternoon, so we would excuse him. Mr. Matanowski, does the government wish sort of a caveat in terms of further cross-examination of Dr. Opposian?
In the future?
In the future.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. We want to caveat that we may not be asking for that.
I understand. And this had to do with an off-the-record discussion that we'll put on the record at some point, but a discussion we held before we began this morning concerning Dr. Opposi needs to leave today. There may be more cross-examination of him later, based on the matters in his testimony that were not included in this report. Is that correctly stated, that, Mr. Matanowski?
That's correct, ma'am.
And Mr. Powers, you all did not object to that?
That's correct, Special Master.
All right. Then, Dr. Posing, you're excused at this point with the understanding that there may be questions for you at a future time. Right, and it would appear to be a good time to take our lunch break. Do we want to discuss the plan proceeding this afternoon before we all break?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So what's the plan from petitioners on what we intend to do this afternoon?
This afternoon, just looking at the expected length of testimony and without really knowing the expected length of cross, but anticipating fairly extensive cross of Dr. Deeth, who's our next witness, my best guess is that Dr. Deeth will take the balance of the afternoon today, and that we would therefore shift our schedule to have Dr. Kinsborn take the witness stand Wednesday morning. I expect he would be done before the lunch break on Wednesday, and my Linda King and George Mead would be available. We anticipate completing both direct and cross in that remaining afternoon session. That's what we would propose.
We would still be done by Thursday.
And we would still be able to get Dr. Mumper That would leave all day Thursday for Dr. Mumper, and I anticipate we would have no problem being done with Dr. Mumper in that one day.
And we still then have Friday available for overflow should cross or directs take longer than expected.
That's correct, Special Master. So that's what we would propose as a schedule, actually for today and running through the rest of the week.
Okay, so we'll plan on taking up Dr. Deeth after lunch. So let's reconvene then at 1:25.
Thank you.
You want to take you want to 1:30?
It's just such an easier number with the differences in our watches, Special Master.
Fair enough, 1:30. Thank you.